Good morning. Good morning, Carla. How are you?
Good morning. I'm fine.
Today, isn't it? City Council will come to order. Today is Wednesday, August 17th, 2011. It's 9:30 a.m. Can you please call the roll?
Saltzman?
Here.
Leonard?
Here.
Fritz? Fish?
Here.
Adams?
Here. And Commissioner Fritz is?
Here. Here.
All right. We'll begin with communications. We have five people signed up. You come up one at a time. Rules of the House are that if you're here representing an organization or a business and acting as their lobbyist, you must disclose that. You just say your first and last name. We do not want your address, and the clock in front of you on that piece of wood will help you count down 3 minutes. With that, can you please read the title for item number 865?
Request of Barry Joe Stahl to address council regarding sow the wind, reap the whirlwind.
Mr. Stahl, are you here? There he is. Welcome back.
Buenos dias.
Buenos dias.
Barry Joe Stahl. What to hand right? Time.
Go ahead and start the clock.
Kenny, with a difficult condition. So you get to meet my alter ego. He's a holy man, Brother Kenneth English. Oh, phone call.
It's too much information.
Mochi, mochi. Hi.
Barry, you got to keep your shirt on.
Sprite? Looks like I got shot, doesn't it?
Barry, you're going to have to put your shirt back on.
Hey, my communication. Don't interrupt me.
I'm the facilitator.
You're the guy
of
that
this
got
meeting.
The whole thing botched up.
All right.
I'm in the most corrupt city in the world. You're taking my time.
No,
took
you
took my
are.
Bathroom to have your little affair with your little boyfriend. So don't interrupt my communication.
Sit
I'm
down.
Expressing and I'm performing.
Sit down. And
I get to
finish your remaining 2 minutes, or I'll have you removed.
I have a federal lawsuit against you right now because you, police commissioner, are a crook. The way we do business here in the city of Portland is you're a bully. So mi amigo, bro, Ken English, broken English, he's going to teach us to. My country, tis of thee, sweet land of liberty, she have a torch. I have a city, Portlandia, she have a trident. I have a trident too. I choose. I don't like you because you're a bully. You say a man. Man's a horse. A girly horse. You back up the girly horse to a donkey called a jackass. They make a mulatto. I mean a mule. That's a half a horse and a donkey half. I think you know what I mean. And I have some acting to do here, and I don't like you interrupting me like you're bully because I file a law against you.
Yeah,
a lawsuit because you have a... sit lie, and because you're a bully, it's a bullshit lie. I mean, we have a funny thing here, the way we count in Portland. One bribe, two bribe, three bribe, kickback, one bribe, two bribe, like a dance. Except for the police, they have a little different. One bribe, two bribe, three bribe, kickback, kick head, grind head on pavement, break ribs, shoot, taser, lie, get promoted. You know, once upon a time, there was a fella who was a horrible, horrible man. Bad criminal came to town. I'm not talking about you. I have a present for you. I'm sorry for your loss. Water Bureau. I took the land over there. Gardening with native plants. Yeah, try that. Remove invasive plants. What do you have over there? I think you're a nice guy, but honestly, if you're the Water Bureau guy, you shouldn't have things that environmental services say are noxious weeds.
Thank
but
you.
The
your
biggest plant.
Up.
The big. You interrupt me.
Your
I
time
agree this.
Is up.
Hey, bully man, you gonna have me arrested? Good day for it. I'm ready to go.
Your time is up.
Mochi mochi.
Your time
Hi.
Is up.
Hi.
We'll now proceed to the next item.
Come by. McDonald's, Sprite, Ichiro,
right.
Ichiban.
You can get up now.
Lofa sashiege. Guys are soze.
All right. Can you please read the title for communications item number 866?
I think it's funny that Fishy, man, he comes here from
Request of Yellen
O. You come here from the other place. It has a Hamilton Fish and Nicholas Fish. They say it's a fish. It'll recycle. I think it's a fish cycle. I don't like carpet baggers.
Goodbye.
I'll see you on TV again.
All right.
Bye-bye.
Can you please read the title for item number 866?
Request of Yellen O. to address council regarding outdoor school and the funding cuts.
That's Korean. You don't know where I've been. I know where you've been. Don't threaten me again. You just violated the ADA.
Sure I did.
You retaliated against me when I'm trying to communicate.
Hi, welcome. Glad you're here.
Everybody knows you're a jerk.
All right, sir.
Harvey Milk.
Get out of here.
You.
Come on.
I don't think he had sex in the public bathroom, kissing a little boy. You won't get the governor that way. You have to rape a little girl like Neil Goldsmith.
All right.
Sorry.
You're done. Sorry for that. Glad you're here. Welcome.
Thank you.
This is democracy. For 3 minutes, people can say whatever they want. And they do.
Mayor, was Barry one of Commissioner Leonard's appointees of the Charter Review Commission?
He's actually a retired city commissioner.
That's what happens.
All right, just wanted to clarify that.
So welcome.
Thank you. Hello, my name is Yellen O, and I am a recent graduate of Lincoln High School. Today, I'm here to testify about one educational and leadership program that has shaped the lives of many in Portland. Outdoor School takes sixth graders from the classroom to the outdoors for 1 week, where they learn environmental science from and are taken care of by high school student leaders and adult staff members. I was a sixth grader at Outdoor School and a five-time returning student leader, and I can confidently tell you that Outdoor School is one key thing that makes Portland the unique city it is today. Why? Well, for a sixth grader, Outdoor School provides endless opportunities. It allowed me, a kid from the suburbs, to interact with students from the inner city. Not only did I make unique and valuable friendships, but I also developed a social and cultural awareness. Outdoor School allowed Jonathan, a student in 2007, who is always described as not the sharpest crayon in the box, to be successful in school for the first time because he learned in a place where he can feel the rock he is learning about and scream at the top of his lungs. At the end of his week at Outdoor School, Jonathan told his student leader that she had taught him more than he ever thought he could learn. Outdoor School allowed Jenna to feel comfortable in her own skin, provided Andy with the unusual three meals a day, and gave Melinda the experience of being outdoors for the first time. Outdoor School also changes the lives of high school student leaders. My experience as a student leader had me realize the importance of community, and now my future plans do not revolve around how much income I can make, but rather how much change I can evoke. I know of many student leaders who are once shy, find their leadership, their voice, and their confidence as a student leader at Outdoor School. And lastly, many student leaders plan to study education and become a teacher because of their experience. And we all know that teachers are some of the most important people in our society. For more information, you can find it in the written material we provided for you. So now, I want to ask you for your support to not let this valuable program be cut from the lives of our students. First, you can give active support. You can make sure the board, the school boards, and the superintendents know that you guys support us. Supporting Outdoor School is a way for the city to support meaningful, effective education. Two, you can look at ways Outdoor School can be supported by city boroughs. We accomplish any goals that include conservation, environmental education, youth development, and the celebration of diverse communities. Three, include Outdoor School as a part of the Cradle to Career framework. And four, personally, you can make a donation at friendsofoutdoorschool.org. Sending one kid for a full week is only $360. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. Well done. Appreciate it. We'll now hear communications item number 867.
Request of Adam Ramlow to address council regarding problems facing Portland State University and Portland citizens.
Hi. Welcome.
Hi. Good morning, members of the council. Thank you for providing us the time to do this democratic process. I'm not going to be speaking of donkeys or anything else So we're through the hardest part. My name is Adam Romlo. I'm the student body president at Portland State University, and I came here today to speak about two different things. One, in my position as an ambassador to students of Portland State University, and two, as an ambassador for my generation. I'm 23 years old, and one of the things we find as a generation that's interesting is that our generation is facing some of the exact same problems as your generation was, and the generation before it, and the generation before it. Certainly, this is true in our education system. The New York Times article reported that the average college debt in 2004 was over $24,000 for a college graduate. And in 1993, that number was less than a third, only $8,000. Rising tuition and rising costs are a problem that all students in Portland's education system face. And PSU is not the only education institute. With PCC, the five different schools, and Mount Hood Community College, there are over 100,000 students that go to school for higher education in Portland. And that's over 100,000 citizens of the city. I worked at Portland State as an orientation leader for the last 2 years, as a tennis club president, and on the Student Fee Committee and the Senate Finance Committee chair. And one of the things that I've been able to experience firsthand is the creative nature and the motivation that students have at Portland State and also in the community colleges. And we maintain at Portland State and in ASPSU student government that creativity and its constant companion of failure are underrated in our education system. We want to be more creative, and we want to fail more often. We need creative solutions. Tim Hartford, author of Economics, argues that the strength of the U.S. economy lies in creativity, and he points to a 10% small business failure every year as evidence to the benefits of creativity. So today I'm here as an ambassador for the students of Portland State University and also for my generation to ask of you, please honor our generation's need and right to a high-quality, affordable public education. What we require now are creative solutions towards this end from our city, our state, our leaders, and our parents. Please be swift, bold, and courageous, and above all, creative with your policies addressing the issues facing our students. I'd like to thank Commissioner Fritz, and the mayor for your time in addressing these solutions. Thank you.
Thank you. Well said. Appreciate it. Let's see. Can you please read the title for both 868 and 869?
868, request of Anthony Stacy to address council regarding thanks for including the veterans community in the Veterans Memorial Coliseum refurbishing project. And 869, request of Harley Waddell to address council regarding thanks for including the veterans community in the Veterans Memorial Coliseum refurbishing project.
Unless there's objection from council, I'll waive the rules and allow these folks to be up at the podium at the same time. No objection, please proceed.
Thank you very much. Good morning, Mr. Mayor and commissioners. We, as the representatives for the veterans community, would like to thank you for this opportunity to address the council today regarding the Veterans Memorial Gardens project. I have a short message I would like to read for the record. We feel it is time for a progress report to be made regarding what is happening at these gardens dedicated to those statewide comrades, friends, and family who failed to return from our country's various wars. Presently, we feel everything possible is being done to properly honor the memories of these men and women at Portland's Veterans Memorial Coliseum. For the opportunity to jumpstart this project, as the veterans community representatives, we wish to thank the folks we are seated in front of. Without this council's blessing and encouragement, this project likely would never have been properly pursued, or if pursued at all, who knows how long it might take. As a final comment, for cultural opportunities and the veterans community's interests, we would like it to be known the Portland Mayor and City Council have accomplished something historically significant by stepping forward and permitting this monument to be brought back to its former glory. Once again, we thank you. On my left is Chris Hoskinson, On my right is Tony Stacy, and for this opportunity, once again, thanks.
I want to thank you, all of you, for your participation in the process thus far and the work yet to come. We really appreciate it.
Thank you.
All right, that gets us to the consent agenda item. Does anyone wish to pull any items from the consent agenda item? Hearing none, Carla?
882, your office requested that be pulled for discussion.
Pulled into the regular agenda?
Yes.
Okay, so 882 is pulled into the regular agenda. And otherwise, please call the vote on the consent agenda.
Saltzman?
Aye.
Leonard?
Aye.
Fritz?
Aye.
Fish?
Aye.
Adams?
Aye. Consent agenda is approved. We will proceed with the 9:30 time certain, which is an important presentation. Can you please read the title for 870?
Safer PDX Project Progress Report.
Commissioner Amanda Fritz.
Thank you, Mayor. It's my honor to present a midway report on a project which started as the Bazelon Project and is now known as Safer PDX. And unlike most project names, SAFER does not stand for anything. It's not an acronym. It's what we're hoping to see and what we intend to see. The goal of the project, in very simple and summary terms, is to reduce the number of interactions between police as first responders and people experiencing mental illnesses on our streets and in our homes in Portland. And it's clearly an urgent issue which we all share. And the group that meets to work on this project is very collaborative, and we recognize that this is our problem as a community, that it's no one person's job to fix it. It's all of our responsibility to work together to figure out better solutions. So we wanted to tell the council and the citizens of Portland what we're doing on this project, and it's my honor to invite up to speak Dr. Maggie Bennington-Davis, who's the Cascadial Behavioral Healthcare Medical Director, Joanne Fuller from Multnomah County, the Chief Operating Officer, Captain Sarah Westbrook from the Portland Police Bureau, and Melanie Payne from the Bureau of Emergency Communications. So welcome. We'll give a short presentation, and then we have some comments from others as well.
I see Judge Julie Franz is there.
Judge Franz is here too.
Yes.
I was asked to appear as well.
Good. Glad.
Thank you, Commissioners. Joanne Fuller, Chief Operating Officer for Multnomah County, and I brought along with me the Honorable Judge Julie Franz, who's the Chief Criminal Court Judge in the Multnomah County Circuit Court. Before we turn it over to Dr. Bennington-Davis, we're going to talk with you briefly about the work that preceded the Bazelon Project, which is the Local Public Safety Coordinating Council's work on the intersection between the mental health and the criminal justice system. These two projects fit together nicely. At the Local Public Safety Coordinating Council, under the leadership of the mayor and Commissioner Judy Shiprack, Judge Franz and I have co-chaired a group that has looked at all of the different intersecting points between the criminal justice system and the mental health system. And in that process, we've taken the recommendations that came from the task force that was originally co-chaired by Ted Wheeler and then Mayor Tom Potter, and done several things to try to improve that intersection. One is the creation of a mental health court, which Judge Franz will talk with you about briefly. Secondly, it's better early identification of people who are brought to our jails who may have mental health problems. One of the things that we found in a study of those individuals that had been frequently booked in our jails is that not only do those folks have significant mental health problems, but many of them have 5 or 6 physical health diagnoses of chronic physical health issues, have had multiple homeless challenges, and have had multiple contact with many, many systems. And so one of the things that we really need to tackle is how we create better communication between those systems that these folks are interacting with on the outside of the jail, and then as they come into contact with the police, move into the jail, how we can better address those issues to try to keep them from ever winding up in the jail to begin with. We Our committee's been working for a couple of years now to try to hone in on those communication issues. And one of the things that's interesting about this work is that it is it's very tedious. It's like there's all these little tiny connections between these different systems, and you've got to make all those connections work in order to get the result that you want to get. And that's been the work of our committee, to really try to address those issues. The other thing that I'll just point out, and then I'll turn it over to Judge Franz to briefly tell you about the mental health court. The other thing that has been a part of our work and a part of the work that Dr. Bennington Davis is going to talk about with Safer PDX is that we've been partnering in a different way in the last few years with the advocacy, the mental health advocacy community, and people who are experiencing mental health issues themselves, and trying to do a better job of bringing those folks into the conversation with both the criminal justice system and the mental health system to try to, instead of doing things to people, to try to engage with them to figure out what is it that people really need from us and how is it that we can do a better job of addressing that. Thank you.
I might just take a moment. Again, I'm Julie France. I'm the Chief Criminal Judge of Multnomah County Circuit Court. In 2010, the 30 most frequently booked people in our jail system were reviewed, and it turned out that 20 of those had significant mental health issues. We thought that was stunning and at the same time not surprising based upon our experience. And as Joanne mentioned a moment ago, many of those have serious physical illnesses, have been involved with many treatment modalities in the community, have been incarcerated numerous times. So this is a population upon whom we need to focus. Moving to the mental health court, after about a part of a year of all the partners in the criminal justice system getting together numerous times a week, we launched a mental health court in October of 2009. From my perspective, and I think the others agreed, that unless we could provide those who could connect those who have mental illness with the services in the community, that a mental health court would not be successful. So in setting up the mental health court, we were able to hire, with money granted through the legislature for diversion, three professionals who could connect the people once released from jail or from the court to the services available in the community. Mental health court is under the supervision of a judge who on a weekly basis meets with those who are in the court. Those who are eligible are suffering from an Access 1 diagnosis, have been screened by the district attorney's office as eligible to participate in this somewhat parallel track with our criminal justice system. It's still under the umbrella of the criminal justice system. Most are on probation. Referrals come from judges, from defense attorneys, from DAs. Most engaged in the mental health court have been charged with low-level offenses, misdemeanors. But as the program has grown, we have been able to incorporate some low-level offenders who have been charged with violent crimes, but low-level violent crimes. Usually those who have aided and assisted are charged with aiding and assisting in a low-level felony. The hope is that through the intense interaction with the presiding judge and with the continued involvement with the mental health advocates who are the connectors in the community and with the resources available in the community, that these individuals will be successful in maintaining treatment, going to therapy, taking their medication, become successful members of our community, and not recidivate, not either victimize others or become victims themselves once released into the community. So we have about 42 people in the program now, capacity for about a dozen more, and so far we think it's very successful with a few very notable graduates. Thank you.
Thank you very much for taking the time to come this morning.
Can I ask a foundational clarification? When you did not mention the word addiction, so how is that? You mentioned the current criminal element or client for services. How has how's the effort sort of looked at addiction issues?
The first off, when we did the study of the frequent flyers in the jail, the people who were most chronically booked in the jail, we found that those people were duly diagnosed, both with addictions and mental health issues. And I think one of the things that we see when we look at when the police have contact with folks that that wind up in real crisis, oftentimes, even though we're identifying those people as having mental health issues, oftentimes they too are duly diagnosed and have drugs and alcohol involvement at the moment of their involvement with the police. The mental health staff who work with the judge in the court have training in both mental health and addictions, and so they're able to really try to tackle both issues. I think a challenge in the treatment community has been that a lot of people in the mental health system, treatment people, don't recognize how much drugs and alcohol may be influencing the behavior of the people who are under treatment to them. And so we underdiagnose people who have dual diagnosis issues, and consequently, I think people have difficulty getting their behavior under control.
Can I follow up on that, Mayor? Joanne, there's a pretty big debate in the community about, and a related piece to this has to do with housing and how you treat people with both mental illness and addictions. And it's been caricatured as wet housing, dry housing, but it really comes down to where's the best place to address addiction issues in the context of also mental health. I know we do both in our community, but could you speak could you address the question of the need for flexibility in how we address the substance abuse issue if we're also going to be successful in getting at the mental health issue? Because I sometimes feel like we have a catch-22 where there are those who say, until someone has become clean and sober, we're not going to address the other needs in their life, which seems to me gets us nowhere. But it's also viewed in some quarters as rewarding bad behavior. If you could just offer your thoughts.
Well, I think there's a couple of things. First of all, we're dealing with a really underfunded drug and alcohol treatment system. If we had treatment on demand in this community, I think there'd be a lot less of a debate about whether or not people had to get clean and sober before you got them into housing, because they wouldn't have to wait to get clean and sober. They could have treatment on demand. So that's an issue that's backed up from the issue that you're talking about, Commissioner. Then when you look at the issue that you're talking about, I think there's two things. I think we've learned that low, no-barrier housing, which means what's called wet housing, is really important to have in the community because people can't get their act together to get clean and sober before they get housing. I think the challenge comes when – so the whole principle of that, as you know, is to try to then entice people into better behavior once they've gotten access to housing. And I think that one of the challenges that we have then is that if people are chronically in that housing for years and years, and we can't entice them into better behavior, they then become a problem for the other people in that housing who are trying to get their act together. And so it is a real struggle to figure out where's the right place. And I think that I'm the older I get, the less of a purist I am. And I think that we need to not think that there's one magic answer to these complex social problems, and that we have to create an array and then move people towards the best outcome we can get them towards by nudging them with incentives and accountability at the same time.
On that point, I'll just say that last week we learned that Governor Kitzhaber had selected Margaret Van Vliet to be the new state housing director, which is a huge loss, obviously, for the city.
I shouldn't chuckle.
And it's an indescribable loss for us. On the other hand, I think it's an inspired choice by him. And what I was encouraged by, Mayor, in reading about reading the governor's statement and some of the press, was that the governor is of the view that you must marry housing and services to be successful with outcomes. And he's of the view, he understands, that that's a cost-effective long-term strategy, and that if we don't find a way to link healthcare and the services with the housing, we're just going to end up paying through other ways much more than if we approach it in a systematic way. So I'm delighted that he sees that, and I think given the work that you and Margaret have done in aligning city and county resources, now that she'll be the chief of the housing operation of the state, I'm optimistic that we'll make some progress on that.
Me too.
Thank you.
Okay, I've got a PowerPoint presentation. Do you have it in front of you? Okay, great. Mayor Adams, commissioners, thank you for this opportunity. My name is Maggie Bennington Davis, and I'm a psychiatrist here in Portland, and I serve Cascadia Behavioral Healthcare. It's really a privilege to be able to present this project to you, and honestly, I think Commissioner Fritz, even Commissioner Saltzman was involved at the get-go, Joanne Fuller, Captain Westbrook, any of them could probably present this project equally as well as I will. So I'm honored that it gets to be me. And it's a really fun project to describe. It's getting national attention. I'm just back from Washington, D.C., where I presented it to the Bazelon Center for Mental Health Law, who is our the main coordinator for the project, and SAMHSA and the Department of Justice. And everyone is really there, has their eyes on Portland and this particular project. So it's a unique and exciting project for Portland. I want to take you back real quickly to the 1960s when the dream of community mental health was born under the Kennedy administration. And community mental health at that time was really seen as the mental health counterpart to public health, to be a preventative systems, population-based way to help people be well mentally as well as physically. It was also meant to be the main place that influenced mental health policy. But of course, as you know, the dream was not realized, and instead what we have, not only in Portland but nationwide, is a system that truly is in crisis. And it's behaving like a system in crisis, where it's a very reactive system, a system that's constantly trying to catch up with its own self. And we're seeing all of the hallmarks of a system that is underfunded and reactive rather than strategic. And in fact, what we've done with, I think we're either in our 11th or 12th year here in Oregon of cuts to the mental health budget, 11th or 12th year. 12th consecutive year of cuts in community mental health, which was underfunded from the very beginning. It's never, ever been funded adequately. So what we've got is really a preoccupation with late-stage crisis intervention, which is not the same thing at all as public health, as you know. And it's left other agencies, other social and public safety agencies, trying to fill the gaps that have emerged, and what we find is that our bureaucracies are often working at cross purposes in this very starved system, and with the different lenses that we look at this population with. So, interestingly, from an anthropologic point of view, perhaps the lack of community mental health resources has increased not only here in Portland but throughout the nation. It has increased involvement of law enforcement with people in emotional crisis. And what's interesting about that is that no other healthcare crisis engages law enforcement the way behavioral healthcare crisis does. So that's just an editorial comment that I think is interesting. The Bazelon Center for Mental Health Law is the nation's premier civil rights agency for a law group that cares about the civil rights of people with mental health and addictions. And they were the group that was responsible for including people with mental illness in under the ADA, the Americans with Disabilities Act, a long time ago. So their interest in this situation is this constant contact between police and people in mental health crisis. And they wanted to analyze what's going on there in order to understand what the key services in mental health, in the mental health and addiction system, are missing in order that winds up happening. And ultimately, Bazelon is interested in getting community mental health back to its intended role. There are five pilot sites in this particular project: Austin, Detroit, Pittsburgh, Portland, and White Plains. And it is known nationwide as the Bazelon Project. And Amanda, Commissioner Fritz, I actually think you are the person who was responsible for the name. So thank you for that, because Safer PDX is, in fact, becoming a national name. The project basically takes interactions between people in mental health crisis on the streets and their interaction with police, and uses that as the moment of defining that there has been a failure in our social system in order that occurred in the first place, and to analyze the heck out of that encounter to be able to move upstream and identify what services could be in place maybe not an additional expense, but perhaps instead of some of the other ways that we spend money. So each of those five cities was chosen for a different reason, and we're not exactly sure why Portland was chosen, but one of the reasons we believe Portland was chosen was something that Joanne Fuller alluded to, and that's that we've had a lot of efforts to understand our system and ourselves, and a lot of collaborative efforts, and I think the Lipsick group that she referred to definitely is a precursor to this effort, and we're able to build upon that. Also, this, I think Portland is ripe to go deeper and further than just trying to understand ourselves. And there have been one of the great, we're about a year and a half into what will be a 3 to 5 year project. One of the amazing things about the project are the offshoots that are coming as a result, not necessarily under the umbrella of Safer PDX, but because that group has been meeting. And the Mobile Crisis Unit with the police is very much attached to the work that we're doing. The way 911 thinks about incoming calls, the Multnomah County Crisis Call Center has really begun doing a lot of introspection about how they might do business, and so on and so forth.
You're going to talk about the Mobile Crisis Unit?
I will in a minute. Yeah, you bet. The most amazing thing about this project, though, truly, are the unprecedented partnerships across bureaucracies, into the business community, into the advocacy community, and that has been an inspiring and really thrilling kind of work. And again, I want to thank many of the people in this room for participating in that effort. Don Berwick, who's the head of Center for Medicaid and Medicare Services in Washington, D.C., currently has a famous quote, "Every system is perfectly designed to achieve exactly the results it achieves." And in fact, this project is founded on that quote, because it turns out when you have inadequately funded and deployed mental health, addiction, social, and housing services, you wind up with people with untreated mental illness, police responding to mental health crises, increased imprisonment, and increased homelessness. And in fact, that's the system that we have. So in order to change that, we have to start someplace. We're starting with partnerships, shared values of this city, looking at the way we deploy the resources that we do have, and then ultimately changing policies. There are three teams, there are three groups on the Safer PDX project, the work team, who actually does the analysis. Some of those people are in this room today. The steering committee, which Commissioner Fritz, Joanne Fuller, Captain Westbrook sit on, and that's really the committee that drives this project, and then the advisory board, who ultimately will be tapped to change policy. The steering committee is unique in that it really does cut across many bureaucracies and the business community and the advocacy community. And so it's that committee meets once a month for 2 hours. Basically, the work is that takes a situation, police intervention in mental health crisis. The work team does root cause analysis and then aggregates the results. The steering committee interprets those findings, and the advisory board will influence policy. This is just a busy slide to show you an example of the work of the work team. I'm not going to go into detail, but they basically analyze the event as much as they can. The first year of information, the root causes of why people are in crisis and draw police attention on the streets, I would have predicted that homelessness and addictions would be numbers 1 and 2. I was wrong. It turns out those are number 4 and 5. The number one reason, that preventable reason, is the fact that when people begin to enter into crisis, information about them that could potentially help them is not shared across systems. And I can talk more about that if you're interested, but it's a fascinating finding. The number two reason is not having access to the correct services for that individual at the correct time. The number three reason is that police are often used to transport people to various levels of care from the streets. And then, as I said, 4 and 5 are homelessness and addictions. Joanne alluded to the tediousness of the work of connecting systems, and that information sharing is really largely a result that we work in silos, and it's not an efficient thing to do, especially in a starved system. To work in silos often means either redundancy or gaps in the system, and indeed that's what we're finding, and that's why that steering committee group is so important, because the right people are at the table to try to break down those silos. In addition to the root cause analysis, we've also done in-depth analyses of the Multnomah County Crisis Call Center, the Project Respond, Cascadia's Project Respond Mobile Crisis, 911, and the calls that they handle every year, and then Portland Police. And so here we are now, a year and a half into it. We're beginning into phase two. And we're really at the point in time where when police are involved with someone, first of all, they get involved pretty late in the cycle, and then they try to find resources for the person, which is very daunting. So what we're trying to do is move upstream, and one of the ways we're doing that is the Mobile Crisis Unit, which is a co-located police officer and a crisis mental health worker in a police car. We're using that literally as the vehicle to move the Safer PDX project forward. And what we're hoping is that that car will be deployed to people who have been using a lot of crisis mental health services and attracting the attention of police, but hopefully before it gets to a crisis period. Those two people then will try to attach that person to services regardless of ability to pay, in order to see if we can actually derail the path that they're on into an actual full-blown crisis. And that car's been up and running now a little over a year. It's gone through some iterations of what it's defined to do. But I really think in this coming year it's going to be an incredibly valuable resource for us to understand what we can do to move upstream so people don't wind up in full-blown crisis, really in the hands of the police. And that's really all I have to say about the project. Obviously, there's tons of information about this project. I'd be happy to take questions. And as I said, there are several other people in this room who can answer as ably as I can about this project. Thank you, Commissioner Fritz, for your support of this project. You've been awesome in the steering committee.
Thank you. I would suggest that should we continue with the rest of our presenters and then take any questions. So, Captain Westbrook.
Well, first of all, I just want to just tag on to what Dr. Bennington Davis just said, and that's about the Safer PDX project. We are very excited to be participating in it. All this collaboration is percolating some wonderful ideas, and I'm just going to go over some of what the police bureau is already trying to put into place. One of the issues that came up is how the calls that come into 911, how do they get sent out to other organizations? Because right now it's primarily just sending police and fire or medical to calls. So Commissioner Fritz held a meeting, and many of us at this table attended, and certainly including the 911 people, and I'll let them talk about that in a moment, but out of those meetings, just talking about what else could we do with the calls of people in crisis, we're already moving forward on pulling in Multnomah County Crisis Line as a partner and starting to transfer more of the calls there that belong there to get the police out of the business that we of mental health and handing it over to people who are professionals at dealing with those calls. And then kind of another piece to that is specifically calls of suicidal people. What we're doing, we've instigated a new protocol in that when the police are responding to someone who is inside their home, there's no one else there, and if they're threatening to harm themselves with a weapon or harm the police, if we try to make entry into the home, then we're being more thoughtful about if we're going to do that. We've come to realize that what we're doing is we're adding pressure to a situation that, and that pressure just by our mere presence isn't as helpful as, well, it just isn't very, it it can end up making it worse. And so what we're doing is often we're just leaving the situation and contacting mental health, having other people by phone contact the person inside, and often through just the letting time be a healer and talking with somebody, we're making less entries into homes, forcing less of those, and so those encounters are not in the middle of the crisis, and working on follow-up later, and that's a significant change of protocol for the police, and I think we're doing a good job. We're going to do more and making sure we're communicating with the county crisis line about when we're doing that, so that all the other workers who are out there, from the Housing Authority to Project Respond to anybody else that might go knock on that door, to make sure that they're involved in that knowledge. As was just said, the information is a huge gap in the system, and we're trying to make sure that we're sharing more of that information that we have, and we're very interested to make sure that we're fulfilling the role that we can fulfill. Let me speak momentarily about the mobile crisis unit in that car. It's a 40-hour a week. They're really trying to find the folks who are not fitting into anybody's systems, and then that's who we're going to be studying during this next year in the Safer PDX project. But in the meantime, seeing if we can get them as much help as we can. So this is just a very exciting project for us. As you know, we have all of our police officers and sergeants who are working patrol go through our 40-hour crisis intervention training. We're continuing to do that. Everyone who gets hired gets trained. And now we're looking at some further training that's going to be happening in our in-service, just to make sure that we're keeping everybody up to date on all the changes happening and making sure that the information is fresh. So I just wanted to thank Commissioner Fritz for all of her work on the council and the with the Safer PDX project, and also just your leadership on that committee that we met with 911 and changing some of those protocols.
Thank you.
May I? I also want to thank Commissioner Fritz for the leadership she's shown on a whole host of related issues, including just the unfolding tragedy of too many people call the streets their home and are not receiving the services they need. One thing that we often get in our office is phone calls or emails from people that say, we're visiting the city or we've come in to shop at the city and we've encountered someone that, by any objective measurement, I'm not a medical person, the person says, but the person appears to be in a very bad place. Maybe talking to themselves, carrying their life possessions in a cart, not having access to showers and toilets and things like that. I mean, you start just adding it up, and the kinds of things that we encounter regularly in our city, where your heart stops and you say, "What kind of country allows someone like this to be here?" So, what we do when we get that information is we call Join, or we call one of our partners, nonprofit partners. There is a kind of intervention, friendly intervention, and it's try to get someone to a better place. What I think sometimes is hard to explain to people is that there are limits to our legal authority to take action unless someone meets a certain threshold. And people say, well, you're a hair splitter, you're playing the lawyer. But I think it's important that we at least just acknowledge this, that there's a very clear standard the courts apply to someone being really at risk of harming themselves or imminent harm of some kind of that makes it, and I know it's a gray area, but we understand the appeals people make. And in a perfect world, nobody in these situations would be on the streets. But what happens is these things get challenged in court, and we have to observe what the rules are. And it's not necessarily a situation of just having resources. I mean, we will sometimes, Mark Jolin and Joyne are sometimes effective in getting someone from a bad place into a better place, and they're right back to where what's familiar to them. There's no good answer to this, but I think to those who think somehow we're dropping the ball or not showing enough compassion, I think it's important to recognize that this whole set of systems are broken, but there's also legal issues that prevent us from just essentially suspending the laws and taking action. We can induce, we can encourage, we can bomb people with services. What we can't do is strip them of their civil rights in these situations, and it's an ongoing struggle. But I appreciate that Commissioner Fritz has made this a priority and has been a good partner in the work that we're doing. So thank you.
Thank you. And I'm going to ask our last three presenters, Melanie Payne from BOIC and Margaret Braden and Terry Walker from NAMI Multnomah, to come up. Because part of, as they get seated, part of the strategies that we're working on with Cascadia and others is to look at how could technology help in some of that information sharing and coordination. Part of that is our new computer-aided dispatch system at the Bureau of Emergency Communications, which, of course, the police use as well. So I'm asked Melanie to come and talk a little bit about what BOIC is doing.
Good morning. My name is Melanie Payne. I'm the Training and Development Officer at BOEC 911. We have enjoyed working on the Safer PDX project because we've seen immediate benefit to how we process calls. Coincidentally, we also adopted a new CAD computer-aided dispatch program this year in April, and that has given us some opportunities that we did not have in the past. For example, this program is much more robust, and for example, we can do searches based on the caller's name. We can also do searches based on the study code, that is, officers, responders, any type of responders can put a study code or indication about following up on a call. And we can now do that search. We weren't able to do that before. So we can provide more information when responders need to know what's happened at a particular location or if they want to get a history of what's happened with a particular caller. We have also discovered some areas that we can do more and better training for our call takers and dispatchers to better handle people who are in a mental health crisis. And that's as a direct result of the work we've done with Safer PDX. So we really appreciate being a part of this. Our call takers and dispatchers work seamlessly and effectively processing about 1 million calls a year. So anything that we can do to improve the service we give to the community is something we are invested in doing.
Well, thank you for your partnership. And I especially appreciate how you're working with the Multnomah County Crisis Line and Project Respond. And as I mentioned at the beginning, this project is only in the middle. As we continue to look at the root causes and what works and what doesn't work, I think that there'll be more that the 911 Center dispatchers with their expertise and professionalism will be able to do to help sort some of those calls more efficiently, while recognizing that the real mental health care providers are at Cascadia and Multnomah County Crisis Line and Project Respond, and that we shouldn't be trying to duplicate services. So thank you very much for your work, Melanie. Margaret?
Actually, I'm going to defer to Terry first.
Hi, I'm Terry Walker with NAMI Multnomah. I was also on the Bassillon Steering Committee. I can't really say that I was part of the planning process, but I was at the meetings. I found online that Bassillon's Performance Improvement Project, PIP, was designed to prevent encounters with the criminal justice system. We've been talking a lot here this morning about the criminal justice system in Portland and communication issues, the complexities and details to see why and how encounters happen. The PIP's original goal was for communities to take a proactive and more cost-effective approach to psychiatric emergencies. Mental health care is, as they say, currently most accessible and most expensive during an emergency, and we all see the value in preventive care. NAMI would suggest noticing how early interventions are impacted by the gaps and bottlenecks in our systems, and what creates barriers to early and effective treatment. We'd like to move upstream even further beyond the mobile crisis team to other community funding for preventive care. Bassillon says their PIP project sees beyond the calls for closer collaboration between mental health and justice agencies or better mental health care in jails. It reframes encounters with the police as failure in the system of care, shifting accountability back. I think we saw this in what Maggie presented, to community care funding. And we want to look at sustainable preventive care alternatives to the overuse of emergency rooms and other crisis situations. Some of the things that I've personally seen, partly through attending the crisis intervention training sessions on the advisory board, is that the police really would like a place that they can drop people off without having to take them to an emergency room and wait while a doctor has a hold, or more readily available subacute care, the 24, well, the, I don't know if Cascadia is currently 24/7 drop-in center is available, but at times it has not been, and that's been a problem for the police. Barriers include timely access to providers. That can include lack of insurance or lack of funding, no evening, weekend, holiday access. Follow-up after ER discharge is low and insufficient community care is available. So instead of pouring funding into understaffed ERs and other crisis situations, we would like to see the community fund preventative community-based services. That's all I have.
Thank you for being here today.
Actually, I do have one other thing. My own family member, I've had to call police to get him help, to get him to a hospital in the past. This has been going back maybe 10 years, and so I'm very familiar with all of the systems and the difficulties in the communication. Since I have been able to get him supportive housing in a different county, actually, because it was more easily accessed there, there have been zero police calls for him. So that's all I have.
Thank you very much. Good morning. I'm Margaret Braden. I'm with NAMI Multnomah, and I'm also the parent of a son with schizophrenia who the Portland police have been intervening about four times in the past month. So I know how the system works, and I know what works and what doesn't work. I think one of the things that I'm feeling as we're talking about all this crisis intervention is, what do we do to prevent the crisis in the first place? And my involvement with NAMI has helped me see a lot of what does work. This past year, NAMI has had over 7,000 encounters with people providing support and education. And what I'm seeing, one of the biggest gaps in the system is early identification and intervention in the schools, in education of families about what mental illness is. One of the things we don't have and that Clackamas County is doing is a big campaign on education about mental illness. And we need funding to support that, because the more we can break down the stigma, the more people are getting help. We also have educational classes that change people's lives. And I'm not here just to do an ad for NAMI. What I'm here to talk about is the wraparound services that people need. They need a supportive environment. We have 9 support groups a week. Everything we do is free and volunteers. There's no waiting 3 weeks to get an appointment. But most excitingly, what I'm seeing, and I get to see every day the benefits of proactive support. We have the North Star Clubhouse, and we now have 57 members. We started a year ago on a thread. We have a little apartment that Providence gives us. And these people are receiving rehabilitation, getting job help, housing help. We also have a program that we spend individual 2 hours on appointments helping people get connected to housing, to services. These are the things that prevent the call. People can come to North Star at any time. They're always welcomed, and they're getting peer support services. We received a county contract to train 46 peer support specialists. And what I'm saying we need more funding for is, well, crisis respite, but again, not getting to that point by having these community services. We do need mobile crisis teams. I had a case the other day where a mother was in desperation. She was the guardian of her child. She called the Portland police, and they refused to take the person to the hospital because they were not of imminent threat of danger. And my interpretation of that is that you're going to have to die within 48 hours. We need more ACT teams. I've seen where ACT teams have prevented the police coming out. It's a much more is a more appropriate way of encountering with people. And I have actually family members who have had that service, and it makes a difference in their life. Home and community-based services, peer support, and expand the mental health court. I had a story.